This is Tape 4, Side A of the Open University course, English 102, Composition and Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, Patty Hartford talks to Basil Johnston, the author of Summer Holidays in Spanish, One Generation from Extinction, and also Don't Call Me No Name. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby, B.C., on February 19, 1993. Basil Johnston is in his office at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, and Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops, B.C.
I'm interested to know, you do this work for the Royal Ontario Museum, technically as an ethnographer.
Let's go back. I am not an ethnographer.
Okay.
I've never studied anthropology, and I don't care to. I'm a generalist, and so I write for the museum. I wrote Ojibwe Heritage, Ojibwe Ceremonies, Tales the Elders Told, and I deliver lectures, and I write on my own.
I wanted to ask you if you think of yourself primarily as a fiction writer or as a nonfiction writer.
Oh. I don't, you should ask other people that. I just write. I don't write fiction. It's all, fiction is another reality. Let's put it that way. Just as music is another kind of reality, you don't put music into categories such as fiction and nonfiction. So why writing? And all these things have been drawn from experience, somebody else's experience. But it's the International Library that categorizes a book as fiction and another book as nonfiction.
What do you think is the most important thing for Native people to write about?
Good grief. Period. I think they should just start writing. Period. Write. There's so much out there to write about, so much inside to write about. They could be composers, musicians, writing poetry, writing plays, writing drama, short stories, long stories, Bibles, psychology, history, philosophy. The question is, why aren't there any more natives writing? It's so rich. The heritage of the natives that they have, if they could only look at it. For example, one of the institutions that was most developed by the Iroquoian peoples, the Six Nations, was that of the Tree of Peace. And that was the institution that the Americans looked at and imitated when they set up their constitution and their government when they formed the United States in 1776. Very recently, a lawyer wrote a book, Dancing with a Ghost, in which he tried to answer questions that he asked himself some 25 years ago. He said, what the hell's wrong with these people? Why do they live this way? Why don't they join the mainstream? Because they have nothing to cling to. But after 25 years, he realized that the people that he was working with had a different understanding of human nature, and therefore another understanding of human conduct and misconduct and the correction thereof, and he wrote about that. It's something that this lawyer, recommended, and that was Rupert Ross, that the Administration of Justice in Canada look at. And if they were to adopt some of that understanding, maybe the justice would be just a bit fairer for everybody. Those are just two examples of the value of some of the institutions that are there that need to be written about. How's that?
That's great. What's your feeling about non-Native writers writing fiction about Native people?
No objection. You know, my regret is that not enough Native people write about themselves. What's wrong with Native people? What keeps Native youngsters from learning their language and their tremendous heritage and writing about it? Because, you see, if they have the language and they know the literature, they have a tremendous advantage over the white people who don't have that.
Who are your own favorite writers?
All kinds of them. You have to read them all. Shakespeare, Milton, Dickens, Momaday, Cronin, Forsyth, Muggeridge, Farley Mowat, Leon Uris, John Steinbeck, and the list goes on. Marvelous passages in all these guys, all these people.
A wonderful variety you've got there.
Well, you know, if you're going to write, you have to read an awful lot, too. And, you know, not all the writings are inspiring or elevating, but there are tremendous passages. And, you know, the reason why these people? Because they happen to suit the style of reading that I like to write. And that is not a knock against, say, for example, Ernest Hemingway. I just don't like his damn writing. Doesn't mean he can't write. It simply means that, you know, it doesn't suit my style, the style of reading that I like. You got to be fair about this thing.
I think this may be your hardest question here. What do you think is your own best work?
All of them. You've got to like all of them, you know. They're they're my babies. It's like a woman who's given birth to a number of children. She doesn't like one better than the other one. She likes them equally. I can't say, you know, this is this best book, this best. There are categories, I think, into which some of these things fall. No, I can't say this is better than this other one. I hope my next one is better in style.
You have a current project you're working on?
I'm a writer. I always have projects.
Okay, what kinds of things do other people say about your work? Critics, peers, family?
I just listen to the people who say nice things about it. The people who buy my books, they're the ones that I listen to.
Do you get feedback from them?
Yes, yes. People will... One of the favorites, of course, is Moose Meat and Wild Rice, which is being published this fall by University of Nebraska Press in the United States under the title of Ojibwe Tales. People like that one. Native people like it especially because Native people like humor. Not subtle humor or dry humor. I don't know what the hell those terms mean. But they like plain old humor. Humorous incidents that take place every day. But among Native people, they don't hide these things. They laugh about them. They talk about them. They don't sweep them under the rug as annual reports of major corporations sweep all the blunders under the rug and publish only the dull, boring stuff.
Let's go back for just a minute to the collection, Moose Meat and Wild Rice. You alluded to the point of origin of Moose Meat Point. It does have a real-life counterpart.
Every single one of those stories happened on some reserve.
Is Moose Meat Point itself a fictional place, which is sort of...
No, it's a real place. That may be found in any native community. It's a fictional name, a fictional place, but the stories are true. There's one story there about the about this little crowd collaring a moose to get the moose to draw this canoe. And, you know, people think this is a wild, wild idea. I was driving along Highway 2428, northern Michigan, came to a little village called Singleton, stopped there for gas, walked into this little restaurant for a coffee, and up over the mantle was this big picture, a moose dragging a canoe full of Americans. A picture taken sometime, I think, around 1906 or 1907. So even the white people corralled moose. I don't know what the results were of that American experience.
It was a great introductory story to the book. It was wonderful.
Yeah, that apparently took place near Moose Deer Point, Ontario. That was the scenario of that particular event.
We've also read in the course a selection from Indian School Days, which presents a kind of sad but funny reminiscence of the residential school experience. Is this a fairly complete picture of your own experience, or have you shaded the picture for the reader?
It's a selection of events that are meant to illustrate the spirit of boys, also meant to portray the character of the boys and the staff from a humorous point of view, who may have been the first group of native boys in a residential school to have gone from grade 9 to grade 12. It wasn't never meant to be a complete picture of the events that took place, you know, over a period of 10 years. Can't, you know, first of all, you can't do that. And somebody remarked, well, writers embellish anyway. Indian School Days is, to me, and my answer to that was, it's a model of restraint.
Have your own feelings about your residential school experience changed over the years?
Daniel, that's a hard question. The feeling at that time, at that particular time in 1940, 41, 42, 43, has never changed. It'll always be that, you know, when you consider that period of time. Well, I felt I was given away. You know, 50 years later, I look on that, I can intellectualize about it. That's about all you can do. In those days, I didn't look at the totality of residential schools as I can now. So, you know, I think that question would have to be rephrased. What do you, you know, in those days we thought that Spanish was the worst one. Nothing, you know, worse than jail, you know, because you're alienated from your family, you're alienated from everything. It's all well at 40 years later, 50 years later, all well for people who have never been, who have never gone through the separation of their families, to say, you know, well, it's no different from private schools. But, you know, if you can look at the experience in terms of a boy or a girl whose family has been separated and who feels that he or she has been cast aside, then you might, in a very small way, understand the hatred toward a system, toward the school. That's how a lot of us felt.
But I don't sense that hatred, that kind of vehemence that I hear from so many, if I can say, survivors of the residential school. I don't sense that in Indian school days, and I wonder if...
Yeah, because that was not my purpose in writing that thing. I had another purpose in writing it. You know, what pulled us through. And the real focus there is from the years 47 to 50. When we were there voluntarily. It wasn't meant, you know. How should I describe it? I could have written a tearjerker, but I didn't want that. I wanted to show something else. And that is why Indian School Days was written the way it was.
Okay.
Because I'm not good at crying.
But you have portrayed the side that you have intended to portray very, very well.
Yeah, because, you know, paper is something else. You can't put inflections on words on a piece of paper. That is why sometimes stories told are so much better than stories written down. They're sort of flat.
You do readings? Do you tell stories or?
I tell stories, but I don't do readings because the thing that you put down on paper is meant for the eye. The story told is meant for the ear. The story written on a piece of paper is meant for the eye and the mind. The story told is meant for the ear and for the heart. And move people. And you can do that much better when you're telling a story or describing something. You can bring life into your words, but you can't do that really when you write.
requires a different set of skills. I do have a question because I realize as I read some of your expository prose just how eloquent you are with the language, and I realize that you have gone through the white man system in terms of education. What effect has that system had on your thinking and on your life?
I suppose, let me answer it this way first. It has made as much difference, I guess, in my approach to things as the natives who first saw firearms, metal things, and adopting these things, it made things easier. But it has not made any difference in the way in which I look on human nature. I still, I look on a lot of things with my in my native heritage. My view of human nature, my view of freedom, my view of what is accuracy, and what you're supposed to do. When a storyteller tells a story, he creates something good, and he also creates it as accurately as he can. That's all that a person can do, and that is what is expected of that person. And it's exceedingly difficult. To us, there's no such thing as perfection. It's a silly damn thing anyway to talk about perfection. We would say, God created good and he created beauty. If he created perfection, all the damn stars would be in rows. All the trees would be in rows. All your mountains would be perfect little pyramids, Squares, cubes, cylinders. But it didn't do that. And as for truth, our word is debwe, which means to cast your knowledge as far as you know it, as far as you've perceived it, according to your gift of description, and which is the highest degree of accuracy. There's no such thing as truth or absolute truth. Tell it like it is, man, as they used to say in the late 60s. You tell it the way you saw it, the way you heard it, the way you felt it, the way you smelled it. And the way you sensed it, and as accurately as you can, given your way with words and descriptions. But the study of philosophy, the study of history, has not changed my outlook. I'm a native. I like the way we think. I like the way we perceive things. I like the way our aspirations, our ideals, our values, because they can sit. As I've written in the foreword, the preface in Ojibwe Heritage, it can stand right beside those of any other peoples. and I don't think I will change. I recognize the value of books, radio, television, film. You know, they're tools by which to project these beliefs, which, you know, it gives us another view of life and enriches one's understanding. That comes from learning another language, somebody else's heritage. And I've always tried to abide by the dictum which may be expressed: Kitchimanitou has given me a different understanding. It is not the subject to your attack. Kitchimanitou has given you a different understanding. That's yours. I should learn from it, refine my own thinking.
I think what you've just explained here is really very, very valuable, especially to many of our students who are not native students and who are not so familiar with ways of thinking. I think that it's very relevant. I'd like to go on to your essay, One Generation from Extinction, where you emphasize the need for the preservation and revitalization of native languages. What's being done today to work towards this goal?
Not enough. I guess, you know, that's the only way in which I can answer that one. In many ways, I am disappointed by what universities have been doing. And I would like to point to one specific example. Lakehead University, which has espoused the teaching of native teachers and the preservation of language. It's a marvelous thing. But that's as far as they've gone. Just language. I understand from reading a couple of native papers that they are going to teach linguistics as a higher level of instruction. In every other language, the progression is from language, grammar, to literature. And by literature, I mean those books and texts that bear the finest thoughts and feelings and speeches and works that are meant to move humankind, to inspire. That's what literature is, to create beauty. You know, in Spanish, you learn Spanish, what the hell for? So that you have access to the finest things in that the Spanish mind will create. Literature. Don Quixote. You learn Italian. You go to literature. You learn German. You go to literature. Any language. Literature. Why Indian languages end up in linguistics? Because they haven't paid any damned attention to native literature.
I think the problem here in terms of recognition is one simply of funding, or does it go beyond that?
Can can't blame funding. There's been all kinds of funding, the last 20 years. But not one university has taken the pains to develop a program in literature. Always ends up in linguistics, which are boring as hell.
Let's go back to the content of One Generation from Extinction. It seems that there's irony in the argumentative pitch of the essay, and that is that aimed at the white scholar to ensure the nation's, I'm quoting here, intellectual and literary heritage. Was it a conscious decision on your part to kick the white community in its most vulnerable spot?
Well, you know what the hell, when you write, that was deliberate. But I tell them now, anthropologists, and these people, instruction is incomplete because they've never studied, taken the pains to study an Indian language. They're all smart enough to do it. But no institution, a university, or museum has required any of its scholars to study and master a native language. And of course, they can't go beyond, the physical culture. And their period of field work is too damn short anyway. 2 years, yay, at most. No, it was deliberate.
I think that there is, however slow it might be, is there change in the right direction, or are we still miles and centuries behind in our need to get moving on this?
Maybe 100 years behind.
But we have some.
But that's where that's where it is. God, as long as they make linguistics the goal, what the hell is the point in language? Play sex games with Indian words. Oh, is this animate? Is this inanimate? You don't learn language that way. Some can maybe, but you don't.
Well, you certainly make it come alive in your own writing. Let's read from Don't Call Me No Name.
I just, that is a story about my uncle and a friend of his. My uncle was John Johnson, and the gentleman that he went to London with to look for work was Mr. John Acuenzi, whom we call John Bucket, the very fine musician who played the trumpet in Lennox Johnson's orchestra. Anyway, shortly after the war, they came back and realized within a few months that there was no work in Cape Croker, a Moose Meat point. So they left, went to London, where they had heard there was a lot of work. On the day of their arrival, they were hired immediately by a factory, and they both found a place to stay. And they, having been in the army, they had been dispensed from certain regulations that bound most Indian people. That is, they could go into a bar, a beverage room, and get served beer or liquor or whatever they wanted. When they came out of the army and they got a job in London, they were refused several places. They were bounced out, and they showed their battle ribbons and their campaign ribbons and their discharge buttons. We served in the army. And I don't care. So eventually they ended up at this hotel on Wellington Street in London. And they decided that since they resembled Orientals, that they would walk into this place and pretend that they were Chinese. And my uncle was a pretty good mimic. And they, before going in, they planned to sit separately so that in the event one got thrown out, at least the other guy could stay in there and have a beer. So they, with this in mind, they walked into this one place. And so they sat down at different tables, and boys, you'd better leave, came this voice. So the waiter was a great big guy. Said, out! And so they were, you know, they said, but, you know, I'm not Indian. I Chinese. Well, before they, you know, they came to that, but me, so here this guy, my uncle, he said, won't serve no Indians, he muttered. Won't serve no goddamn beer to no Indians. Hey, me, yes, I've been thinking, said Connor, suddenly serious. You know, you look kind of like Chinese. Don't you call me your names, glowered Migas pugnaciously. No, I didn't mean it like that. Listen to me. Let's go in there and pretend we're Chinese. Migas nodded doubtfully, meaning that he was not averse to the idea, as long as it worked. And so Migas and Kunas entered the Royal Alexandra with Kunas shuffling ahead in what he felt was accepted Chinese fashion. They sat down, and a bouncer appeared like a genie. We don't serve no Indians here, he barked. Don't call me no name, I'm no Indian, I'm Chinese, replied Kunas testily in his finest Chinese inflection. He rose indignantly with his cane, the bouncer paled. Sorry, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean no insult. You have to be careful, you know. Not allowed to serve Indians. Please accept my apologies. You're better, said Kunas, shaking his cane ominously. What would you gentlemen like? Ah, two blue ribbon, plenty tamplas, replied Kunas, sitting down. Migas and Kunas covered their grins with what they felt were appropriate Chinese bows. They enjoyed their beer very, very much.
Well, I thank you very much. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I think our students will really enjoy listening to the things you had to say.